Coming up on KUCB News, the alert level at Makushan Volcano has been downgraded, and Bristol Bay activists and social workers are attempting to draw attention to missing and murdered Indigenous persons. Stay tuned.
Programming on KUCB is made possible by Redfish Electronics, now providing new, used, and refurbished computers, tablets, iPods, MP3s, phones, phone accessories, and flat screens. We also carry external hard drives for your digital storage needs. Redfish Electronics is located in the airport parking lot next to Northport Rentals. Redfish Electronics can be reached at 359-2205.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM on Alaska. I'm Maggie Nelson with some local news on Wednesday, September 9th, 2020. Scientists have downgraded the alert level at Makushan Volcano after a sustained pause in unrest. Officials with the Alaska Volcano Observatory say the seismicity has been steadily declining for months following an earthquake sequence near the volcano that began in mid-June. All of the earthquakes were clustered about 6 miles east of the summit of the volcano, at a depth of about 5 miles below the surface of the Earth. The largest earthquakes were felt strongly by residents of Unalaska. Current observations show the seismic activity at Makushan has returned to background levels. Therefore, scientists have lowered the alert level from advisory to normal, and the aviation color code from yellow to green. Makushan is located on northern Unalaska Island, about 16 miles west of the community of Unalaska. The broad, ice-capped stratovolcano is the site of frequent steam and minor ash eruptions, according to the AVO. But no large eruptions have occurred in this century. KUCB's partnership with ProPublica began last week. KUCB General Manager Lauren Adams says the investigative journalism nonprofit selected our former reporter, Zoe Sobel, to join its local reporting network, along with five other public radio station reporters across the country.
We were hoping to get reporter Zoe Sobel back in Unalaska following her time in Asia with the Loose Scholars program. And so we were kind of talking about that, and then Zoe took it upon herself to actually put in this application to ProPublica. So she wrote the grant, and she worked closely with me to get it turned in, but I was very excited when we became finalists. I was surprised and delighted because it's a really prestigious program to be a part of.
The program will cover Sobel's salary and benefits for the year. Adams says it's exciting because we will have another reporter in the building. But, she says, it won't look like other times when we've had multiple reporters in the news department. Rather than producing daily coverage, Sobel will be working on a long-term investigative project with editorial support from ProPublica out of New York City and Coast Alaska out of Juneau that will result in around 15 to 20 stories over the course of the year.
I think that the goal here is to get high caliber investigative reporting in our community for 1 year. And it's just going to add more editorial capacity in our organization and also just have another reporter who already knows the community come in to pick up some stories about our community and our region.
Adam says the partnership will help elevate the quality of the KUCB newsroom and teach our reporters more investigative reporting techniques.
We don't do much with investigative reporting, and for people who are listening that aren't in journalism as a field, mostly what we're doing is real quick turnaround stories on the things that Unalaskans need to know right now on the breaking news. And for Unalaska, there is a huge amount of breaking news, and I don't need to tell you that, Hope. We have just a huge backlog of stories all the time that people want to hear. And so, you know, we very rarely have time to take a step back and look at a single issue and investigate and do deep dives into that topic.
According to Adams, this is a chance for everyone involved to gain some unique experience.
With ProPublica, we are taking one person and putting that person on a different beat and giving Zoe Sobel, in this case, a chance to really focus and learn. And I think she's going to really grow a lot as a reporter. And I think, you know, all of us as a station will learn a lot this year.
The ProPublica Local Reporting Network was introduced in 2018 to help create vital investigative journalism in communities where these stories would otherwise not be done. Since inception, the program has worked with more than 40 newsrooms. Civil rights groups are challenging the Alaska state law that absentee ballots be verified by a witness, saying it's an unconstitutional burden on voting rights during the COVID-19 pandemic. The lawsuit is being brought against Lieutenant Governor Kevin Meyer, a Republican in state court. The plaintiffs are the Tribal Council for the Interior Alaska Community of Arctic Village, the Alaska branch of the League of Women Voters, and two elders who say they're at high risk of severe illness from COVID-19. They're being represented by three public interest law firms, including the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska. Josh Decker is executive director.
What Lieutenant Governor Meyer is doing is he's forcing Alaskans to choose between their health and their vote. For anyone in Alaska who does not have an adult who can witness their signature and wants to avoid risking COVID, they should be allowed to cast their ballot in November, just like those Alaskans who live with someone.
Last month, Decker's group and the others wrote to Meyer asking him not to enforce the witness signature requirement. They say that requirement led to the rejection of 456 ballots in last month's primary election. Meyer wrote back last week saying that the requirement is set out in state law and that he doesn't have the authority not to enforce it. In fact, he says telling voters that they don't need a witness could risk having their ballots thrown out during a subsequent court challenge. Decker says that Meyer's highest duty is to uphold the U.S. and Alaska constitutions, including the Alaska Constitution's explicit guarantee of the right to vote. State officials said last night that they need time to evaluate the complaint filed in the lawsuit. Decker says his organization will continue to monitor Alaska's election procedures in an effort to uphold access during the pandemic.
We're keeping an eye out on it. It's important that every Alaskan is able to count to cast their ballot in November and to have those ballots be counted.
Yesterday's lawsuit is the second filed over Alaska's absentee voting program during the pandemic. In July, several other civil rights groups sued the lieutenant governor over his decision to mail absentee ballot applications to voters older than 65, but not to everyone else. Alaska's tally of confirmed COVID-19 cases rose by 65 yesterday, bringing the statewide total to 6,790. That includes residents and non-residents who have tested positive for the virus. There have been 245 hospitalizations since the pandemic hit Alaska in March and 42 deaths. Meanwhile, a new federal initiative to track cold cases of missing and murdered Indigenous persons is up and running in Alaska. The state's office opened late last month. In Bristol Bay, local activists and social workers are focused on drawing attention to the issue, something they've been doing for years. KDLG's Tyler Thompson reports.
Tribal Judge Ingrid Cumberledge is the state's first missing and murdered Indigenous persons coordinator. Cumberledge is Aleut and Tlingit. She's from Sandpoint, and she's worked there as an educator and tribal court chief judge for 30 years.
I came to this job because I was concerned about what was happening in rural Alaska. And in my community, we've had individuals go missing from the community as well, later to be found after they had passed away. Some real concerns about that. I'm concerned about what's been happening in Bristol Bay.
There are no official statistics for missing people in Bristol Bay. The Urban Indian Health Institute, a tribal epidemiology center based in Seattle, reports that 52 Indigenous women and girls are listed as missing or murdered in Alaska, the fourth highest of all states. But a failure of state and federal agencies to collect that data means it's impossible to know the scope of the epidemic. In her new role, Cumberledge will work to change that. She's developing resources like a database for tracking missing and murdered Indigenous people for communities across the state. Cumberledge says she's also putting together a small working group of victim personnel, tribal representation, and local law enforcement.
The reason that we kept it small was to make sure that we could get some good communication going and work on some of the initiatives. Improving communication when something happens, making sure that the data is getting recorded at the local, state, and federal level, and also that the response to any event is as thorough as it can be.
Cumberledge is working to establish protocols for local responders to follow when they have to wait for state troopers to arrive. She says troopers will be responsible for individual cases.
They're going to be joining the task force. The object is just to kind of review what we're doing and how they're doing things, but also how we're doing things in tribal villages and in villages that don't have enforcement.
The seven MMIP offices opening around the country are part of increased attention to the epidemic on the federal level. Communities have been grappling with missing and murdered Indigenous peoples epidemic on the ground level for decades. Greg Marksmiller is the Education Outreach Coordinator at SAFE, a women's shelter in Dillingham.
The amount of trauma that the loss in our community from missing and murdered Indigenous women is so apparent, and the fact that everybody here has had to deal with it in one way or another means it's all of our issue to deal with.
SAFE has organized public speaking events at the Dillingham schools, marches to raise awareness of sexual assault and domestic violence, and talking circles in communities across Bristol Bay. People are using art to address structural barriers.
I got into murdered and missing Indigenous women advocacy work 3 years ago when I started a gospel project.
That's Amber Webb, an artist and activist who grew up in Dillingham and has worked to shed light on MMIW in Alaska and in Bristol Bay. In 2018, Webb hand-stitched a giant cusbuck and illustrated on it the faces of missing and murdered women from around Alaska. She says she wanted to honor the women who were lost and to bring awareness to the underlying causes of MMIW.
Originally, that project started because I couldn't even find data that reflected accurate numbers for Alaska, and just kind of realizing how little it was being done. Just sort of, it's the kind of problem where you try to do anything you can when you realize that how grave the situation is.
Webb has since been collecting data from families, local news reports, and police reports. She says a lot of this data collection has been happening on a grassroots level. The Sovereign Bodies Institute is one of the organizations that compiles such data.
In 2018, Anita Lucchesi, who started the Sovereign Bodies Institute, unveiled the very first Indigenous-led database where she was collecting the names of murdered and missing Indigenous women. And since then, there's been a lot more research work around this issue, but we still can't really give an accurate picture of those numbers, even within our own region.
Webb says that along with state and federal efforts to address the MMIW epidemic, to begin to heal, institutions and individuals need to examine sexism and racism in their own operations and in everyday life. Then, they need to take concrete steps to change. With help from Izzy Ross in Dillingham, I'm Tyler Thompson.
To find out more about the Sovereign Bodies Institute, visit their website at sovereign-bodies.org. Again, that's sovereign-bodies.org. Jojo is an Unalaskan who loves hiking, loves fish, and enjoys catching up with his neighbors. In other words, he's a lot like most people on the island. The striking thing about Jojo, though, is that he's a cat. Silently, crouched low to the ground, Jojo the hiking cat pursues me as I trek up Nirvana Hill. If it hadn't been for the long green and yellow reflective fringe and bell hanging from his collar, I would have had no idea how closely he trailed.
He's the best. Look at him.
That's Marisa Tovar, one of Jojo's owners and devotees. Tovar says Jojo is always free and never goes out on a leash. And while he's unsuccessfully tried to join her in the kayak, he prefers to stick to the tundra and hiking buddies rather than roaming into town on his own. Although Jojo didn't have a whole lot to add during the hike, he was generally distracted with cheekily avoiding my camera, stopping for water breaks along the creek, or stealthily sneaking up behind me, Tovar and her partner, Harish Wasavan, were excited to dote on their beloved Jojo.
He goes to people's house and he does this thing, Jojo spread, where he spreads himself, you know, like, you know, it's kind of funny to see. I mean, you can't help it, like, you know, if he shows up like that, then you would definitely, like, give something, you know.
He works it. He knows how to work
it. Wasavan and Tovar both agree that it's hard to deny Jojo when he spreads out on the ground, taunting you with the soft, white, contrasting inner side of his belly, a move they refer to as the Jojo spread. And as Tovar notes, it's a move he uses frequently to get treats and attention from many people in the area. She says that while he doesn't do much real hiking without a partner, he roams the neighborhood, making daily visits to old friends.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my
God. So he has a favorite neighbor that gives him tuna. Like, and he'll just go, and he knows the sound of his car.
he gets home for lunch and I've seen him. Like, he'll just like wait and then, you know, he'll leave his door open and there goes Jojo. And he has his own water bowl and food bowl in someone else's house.
Before he became a member of the Tovar Wasovan household, Jojo lived as a stray, on and off, for nearly 3 years in Unalaska. And while he managed well living as a stray, Tovar says that he acclimated quickly to domesticated life. Tovar says she found out that Jojo was a hiker when she'd go downstairs and put her shoes on, getting ready to hit the trail. Jojo started begging to go, she says, and so they began bringing him on their hikes, and he just continued to follow.
We even tried to go kayaking the other night. We were carrying the kayak and went, you know, to the lake. And Jojo shows up and then, you know, he's like right there on the bank. So then I'm like, well, how do you like try to get him, I guess, if he wants to come? But he wouldn't want to, he didn't want to come in the water. So then he was freaking out. And
like most of the cats on the island, Jojo is instinctive, strong, and a survivor. While he loves luxuries like canned tuna, fluffy beds, and practically every window at home, and even a personal Instagram account, Jojo is a hunter at heart, so much so that Tovar says she had to buy him a special collar and bells to keep him from bringing home birds.
When he does bring them home and they're not alive, like, he'll eat the whole thing. Like, he'll just, like, chomp on the head first and then just, like, it's gone. Like, I've never seen that before, but... The funny
thing is, based on his hunting abilities and years of living as a stray, Tovar anticipates that Jojo will continue hiking with her in Wasovan throughout the winter. Tovar says she didn't bring Jojo home until this past spring, so this will be her first real opportunity to take him out in the winter weather. And this will be Wasovan's first chance to take Aleutian winter hikes with Tovar as well, as this is their first winter living together and his first on the island. Despite the new living arrangement, the three of them seem to be getting on just fine, so long as Jojo gets his way.
The house is called Jojo Mansion, and there's like a bed for him on almost every window, yet he would just come and sleep, you know, like...
on whatever you're working on. Yeah.
The vet and dentist are in town this week. Aleutian Pet Care will be taking appointments through Friday at the Burma Road Chapel. They can be reached by phone at 359-1876. That's 359-1876. Also, Dutch Harbor Dental is taking appointments through Monday, September 14th. Dr. Nathan Faber and his team can be reached at 581-3828. Again, that number is 581-3828. They are also scheduled to return to the island in October and December. For more information, visit our community calendar at kucb.org. And that's the news from Unalaska. I'm Maggie Nelson, and you're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM. Find us online at kucb.org. And please stay tuned for your local and marine weather forecasts.